Okay, so if I break out with a big red nervous rash, we all know why. Well, my name is Megan. I was born in Dalton, Georgia. I grew up in LJ. That's still where I live now. I was born to two alcoholic parents. Actually, alcohol ran in my family rampant. It was a generational thing. I'm the first one, not technically the first one, but the first one who tried to do this the right way and not be a dry drunk. I was taught resiliency through my grandpa growing up. That man could pick anything up and lay anything down. He was one of the best things that ever happened to my life. My mom and dad divorced when I was two. I was raised by my grandparents on my mom's side. I didn't know my dad's side of the family very much. But that comes with healing from trauma as a child comes with time and a lot of mistakes of your own growth. My mom finally came back when I was seven. She battled her addiction all the way up until 4 years ago. Life growing up in LJ is completely different than life growing up in the city. We are barefoot hillbillies. It was in our family blood to make liquor, fight, run around barefooted, of course, you know. But I had a great childhood. My grandparents did the best that they could to make up for, we would call it guilt parenting now, but they did the best they could. Really, they spoiled the shit out of me. My mom came back whenever I was seven. She did great for about 7 years, and then she kind of fell back off. And then by that time, I was old enough to go with her, and off we went. So my drinking started when I was 11 years old. Actually, it started before that. My dad had put a beer in my bottle whenever I was like one. But I loved alcohol. I loved it. It took away all the hurt, all the pain. It suppressed everything that I had dealing with because I didn't understand what it was that I was dealing with at all because I was too young to understand what it was that I was dealing with. I was too young to understand what the pain was, where it was coming from, and what it was caused by. Now, as I'm older and I've gone through the process of my 12 steps and I've gone through some therapy, I understand now that my parents did the best that they knew how. They did the best at what they could. And I used my mom being gone a lot as a crutch as to why it was that I did the things that I did until I was in, I'm 37 now, and it was in my mid-30s, like 32, 33, that I realized I woke up one day and I was in jail, of all places, and I was like, my mom was raising my son, and I'm like, I am her. And that is the most humbling experience of your life because you spend so much time going, I'm never going to be that way. I'm not going to be like that. I'm not going to be like that with my kids. And then you wake up one day and you're like, well, never say never. And I learned how to have forgiveness. Whenever I met Josie, that was a point in time in my life when complete surrender happened. And whenever they tell us in this program that that is what we need to have and that is what we need to get, it is exactly that. We need to have complete surrender because we are powerless and our lives were unmanageable. And there was nothing that we could do about it because who got us there? We did. So complete surrender to my higher power, who I call God, is the best thing that ever happened to me. And it was face to the floor in a booking, in a holding cell in booking in Gilmer County Jail. And I was screaming out everything that I had ever done wrong. And I mean everything. And I was screaming it out. I did not care who was in the holding cells near me because actually it's so funny because two girls that were in the holding cells near me actually some of the things I springed out was about their husbands at the time. You know, so like, that's a humbling experience and it's help right there too. You know, so, but I was so completely ready because what led me to that point, because I like to focus in my story, I like to focus more on what I've gotten out of it, not as much as what I did, because we've all done things. What led me to that, though, was something that I haven't ever shared in my story. So 2 years ago, I was naive and thought that I was a Billy Badass and, you know, I was going to run with the big dogs. And I ended up being put into a sex trafficking ring. And I didn't understand what it was that was going on because I was from the country. We didn't do things like that around where I grew up. You didn't have to worry about being somebody that might be on a cold case files episode later. And so whenever I got into the midst of it, I didn't understand that that's what was going on. But I made it out of there, and I've come to find that there has been 5 girls that weren't as lucky as I was to make it out of there, which is another humbling experience in itself. But after that, I realized that I could have been that girl dead in that ditch. And because I never called home and I never let my mom know where I was and I never talked to my son because I was too ashamed of who I was, nobody would have known to look for me. And that is a huge thing to have on your shoulders whenever you realize you would have been that girl in that ditch somewhere that nobody would have been able to put a name to for how long. And if anybody ever even found you. So I was like, well, okay. So I started going to the only places that I trusted anybody, and that was graveyards. They couldn't hurt you there. They didn't want nothing from you. They weren't trying to take anything from you. They weren't trying to take your innocence from you. They weren't trying to take who you were away from you. And they didn't have anything bad to give to you. You know what I mean? So I would go to every graveyard because I walked everywhere I went, barefooted. And I did it with a bag on my back. And I lived rough. I lived in the woods, straight survivor mode. And I'd go to the graveyards and I'd pick every rock, every stick that was on somebody's grave site, I'd pick it up and I'd clean it up. And if there was those flowers, you know how you see flowers in the graveyards, they're wrapped around in the woods behind them. You know, I'd pick flowers up and put flowers on whatever grave didn't have flowers. Just I wanted to do something good. And I ended up in a church, at a church in Blue Ridge, and it was on a Wednesday. And I don't know what changed on this day, but God changed my life. And I sat on the church steps there. Instead of hiding when the congregation showed up, I sat there. And I waited, and I waited, and I waited. And I had all these bags around me, and I was just looking crazy because I got a hold of a pair of toenail clippers and cut all my hair off. And, like, I don't know what I was thinking. It was so bad. I took a Kershaw pocket knife and cut the length off of it, and then I took these toenail clippers and cut myself some fancy bangs. They looked great, didn't they, Josie? Yeah. When Josie met me, it was still bad. Woo. But I sat there and I waited on the congregation to show up. And when they came, I'm sure they were like, oh, God, what have we got here? But they were really sweet, and they said, ma'am, what can we do to help you? You know, is there anything we can do to help you? Can we get you a hotel room? Can we do this for you? Can we do that for you? And I said, nope, you can just go ahead and call the law. I'm tired. So they called the sheriff's department in Fannin County, and they came and got me. And Fannin County met Gilmer County, LJ, halfway down. And this was one of the moments that impacted me the most is the officer who came to get me, his name was Parks. And he said, Megan, do you know how long we've been looking for you? And I said, nope. He said, 2 years. He said, it wasn't because of any warrants that you had. He said, it was because of the potential we knew you had, and we knew that you wanted to do better. I said, boy, I wish you hadn't stopped looking for me. I said, good, now to leave it. I wish you kept on. That could have been a statewide thing. It'd have been all right with me. But I got to Gilmer County Jail, and I released everything in that holding cell because I knew that that was the one thing after 16 years of trying recovery that I had never done. I had never given up my control over what it was that I was doing. I'd give it a little bit, you know, I'd be like, okay, I'm going to do this your way, this way. And then behind the scenes, I'm going to do this Megan's way. Because what y'all don't know is it going to hurt me. You know what I mean? But that's not how this program works. Complete honesty and surrender and acceptance and trust are some of the biggest things that I've gotten out of this life. I have 2 years sober in July. And it only took me 16 years to actually have 2 years sober, but I did it. I've learned so much from the people in these rooms. Each and every one of us touch each and every one of our lives every single day. Every day. We are that attraction and that promotion. You know, it's attraction rather than promotion. We are the attraction that this program has. We never know who it is that we touch and what it is that we do in our day-to-day life. No matter how small it is, we never know what it is that we do to impact somebody else's life. Whether they get it right away or it doesn't sink in till later on down the road, they'd be like, oh, I saw that light in the dark one time. I saw that light shining through this person's eyes one time whenever they were good to me and they give me a dollar. Or they were good to me and they give me a smile and a piece of hope to live on in this world. Because that's what this world is lacking. We lack hope. And you never know when it's going to be you who's that one piece of hope that somebody sees to carry on with their life that day. I'm so passionate about the fact that it is our job to be able to save someone else's life. And it's not that big of a task to do because all you have to do is be yourself. Do the next right thing after the next right thing after the next right thing, and it becomes a habit. It's not even something you have to think of anymore. It's something that just comes naturally. And the quality of life is so amazing. In 37 years, I had never bought my own car, had my own home where I didn't live with a man who paid my bills. And I got my son back. And I got my son's forgiveness. It took almost 2 years, but, you know, that's a lot less than what it was that I put him through the 14 years of his life. But I have my own vehicle that I saved up the money for and that I paid for. I have my own home that I pay the bills in. I don't have cable or Wi-Fi, but that's okay too. But I've come so far. Like, it is such an honor to be asked to speak at a place like this for me. Because I'm like, okay, whose life can I touch today? Whose life can I save a little bit, a little piece of something? Hopefully something that I says goes somewhere with somebody and resonates and they can share it with the world. Because we are those miracles that people talk about on a daily basis. It is us. You wonder if you're worth something some days? Girl, men. Wake up and look in that mirror and be like, I am working my 12th step on myself today. Yes, I am. I'm going to be saying, okay, I am powerless. My life was unmanageable. I am not God, but He is, and thank God that I trust Him and that He loves me, because there's been a lot of times whenever I could have been in a lot different places than I am right now. I am so proud of the people that I've met and the people that I know in this program, because they helped save my life. The 12 steps mean different things to different people, but my favorite steps are 6 and 7. To me, those are surrender steps, and I do those daily. I humble myself on my knees every single morning. And I tell the good Lord to please show me what it is about myself that I need to change that day. Even if it's something just a little bit different than it was the day before, at least it's something different and I'm continuing to keep going. I want to be the most humble child of God that I can be. And I've never tried to be anything more than what Megan wanted to be. And since I have applied the fact that it's not about me to my life, it's been great. My son, he told me before I come down here, he's like, you need to let me go with you and help you tell your story. And I'm like, we're just going to leave those details out. They don't need to know every detail, son. And he said, well, he said, you just remember, it doesn't matter how ugly it's been, Mama. He said, you never know who it is that you're going to help with what it is you're saying. And I'm like, you've been listening to me. I love that. I love that because I'm finally worth listening to. I have a great sponsor, and she always tells me all the time, she uses the AA mottos, and I love them because whenever I first came into AA 16 years ago, I learned them. And believe it or not, whenever you go to AA the first time, you go back out and try to drink, and it's ruined it. It has. Because you're like, oh, that's what they said. Yeah. And then you have to admit somebody's right, and you're like, crap. You know what I mean? So, but just those little AA mottos get you through the day, you know, one day at a time. Suit up and show up. But my favorite thing that I'd ever heard was this quote right here. And it was, when the fear of remaining the same becomes greater than the fear of change, we will surely let go. And ain't that true? Whenever you are so sick and tired of being sick and damn tired of who you are as a person, what else is there to do but change? And change is terrifying for us. You know what I mean? Well, some of us. I like adaptability. It's fun for me. You know, but change and grief is a huge thing, too, that comes in with recovery that I've noticed in this program. And the 12 steps and the 12 traditions really help you be able to get over that, get through that grief process, because we grieve losing the old, our old selves. We don't realize that grief isn't just from a loss and death. You know, we grieve losing who we were. It was all we'd ever known. So it's not just a change that's scary. It's the whole acceptance of who you, of what you're going through, all the stages of grief, which they've added two more to it, which is just crazy. There was five, but now there's two more to have to go through. So, and you're bouncing back and forth between all of them. You're like, God, just help me keep up with myself. yeah. And I still do that too some days where I'm still like, God, please just help me keep up with myself. But I'm also in a program in LJ, it's the drug court program, as Josie has said. And any program that you go through that is designed to help you better yourself is all about how much you apply yourself to that program. It's all about what it is that you want out of it. And if you want enough out of it and you're tired enough of being where you are, you'll jump through any hoops that they ask you to jump through, no matter how crazy they seem or unfair they seem. And with the AA program, I love it because it's something that never ends. Drug court ends, but I can always depend on the fact that AA is always going to be there for me. I can always depend on the fact that I can walk through a door anywhere that there's a meeting and somebody's going to say hey to me and somebody's going to make me feel loved and accepted and not look down their nose at me like I'd done something that they had never heard of. And that's what we don't need to make each other feel judged as a human race, not just in the AA, but as a human race, because we are no better. A sin is a sin is a sin. We are no better than the other. We all strive and fall and fail and get back up, but the point is that we get back up. The point is if you walk out of these rooms and something happens and you need to come back in and get a white chip, there isn't anybody going to tell you that you're wrong for doing that. And where do you get that from anywhere else besides here? You do that somewhere else and they're all going to be looking at you going, oh, this is what you did. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know I did it. I was there. Yeah, I know. I know that's what happened. I was there for that one. Yeah. I may have been inebriated, but I was there. And there are times where you're kind of happy that somebody did tell you what it was that you'd done because you may actually not remember. Yeah. But I don't really know how much longer I have.
20 minutes.
Oh, God, buddy. You're killing me. Okay. I guess I could go back into my story a little. My mom had been married 8 times. And I had had quite a few stepdads over the period of years. And trust is, when it gets broken when you're a child, is a lot to have to deal with as you grow. My stepdad that I had just one time, he was a strange man. He was a weird man. But he would like to hold my covers up and watch me sleep at night. And I told my mom about this, and her response to me was, Megan, he's a good provider. So we're just not going to talk about this anymore. So immediately, whenever you're trying to tell the person that you're, it's ingrained in you from birth to trust what's going on with you, and they just push it off, you're like, this is odd. This is not the way. Even if you're a child, I was 7, you don't understand. And then for 8 years, I lived with that man doing that every night. But in hillbilly country, that's the way that things were dealt with. They were all just pushed under the rugs. So now that I'm older, I understand that my mom went through the same things, and she was just carrying on the same traditions that she was taught as well. It took a lot to be able to forgive my mother as I grew up. I chased after her acceptance. I just wanted her to want me to. My dad, on the other hand, was just a severe raging alcoholic, and he was going to do whatever it was that Steve Griggs wanted to do. And as I grew up, he was in and out, not by his choice. It was if I went to see him, I got to see him. If I didn't, I didn't. I got a phone call whenever I was in jail one time, and it was my sister's uncle, which we had the same dad, and he was letting me know that my dad was in the hospital, which was something that never happened, ever. That man would never go, he's not going to the doctor, because if he went to the doctor, they were going to tell him to quit drinking, so he's not going to go to the doctor. Well, he called me and he said, your dad's in the hospital. And immediately my legs flew out from underneath me and I hit the floor. And I knew in that moment that my dad was sick, like he wasn't going to live. And so they let me out of jail and I went to see my dad. And he said, well, he said, I've lived a long life. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, I have hepatitis C, and I have cirrhosis of the liver. And I said, well, after about a gallon of rum every day for the past 40 years, I'd say you probably do. And he said, they've given me 6 months to live. He said, and the doctors have told me to get to know my daughters very well over the next 6 months. His body weighed 99 pounds and his belly was as big as a 55-gallon barrel. They would draw 4 liters off of him every day and it still wasn't enough. He tried his best to get to know us as well as he could, but it only took him 2 months. And he was gone. And when he passed away, me and my younger sister got together, and it was all. I was drunk. I was so drunk. And the day of the funeral come up, and me and my sister, like I said, we fight up there. Me and my sister were fighting. I mean, fist fighting in our mama's yard. The morning of the funeral, we were fist fighting. Both of us had black eyes at the funeral. We were both drunk, bad drunk. I showed up in a dress that you should never wear to a funeral. Never, ever, like, ever. Especially not if you're going to bend over in the casket and kiss your daddy and not show everybody behind you everything. Because I did. And I was wearing a pair of white Converses just like these. And I stunk. I hadn't had a shower in, I know, 4 days. And my whole family, we walked in, and my dad raised my sisters, but he didn't raise me. But I knew who he was. You know, birthdays and Christmas, I got the cards. You know what I mean? But when we walked in to do the final services, the whole family, you know, sits on the front two pews. And I went to sit down with the family, and the only spot that was left was next to my middle sister, and she picked her son up, my nephew, out of her lap and sat him down in the only empty seat there, and nobody looked at me. Nobody even raised an eyebrow to the fact that I was standing there wanting to sit down with my family at my dad's funeral. I sat at the very back, all by myself. And I wasn't the only one that was drunk, you know what I mean? So I know that wasn't the only thing that was keeping me from being able to sit there. So in the midst of the pain of losing my dad, I felt like an outcast. So I was sitting there, and my dad's friend started giving the eulogy, and I just got it in my head, and I thought, well, ain't no need for me to be here. So I got up in the middle of the eulogy at my dad's funeral, and I walked out. My youngest sister followed me out, which was a big mistake. And because we both had already been fighting. You don't want to follow me out and try to find out what's wrong with me. You know what I mean? Because I'm going to cuss at you. And we ended up fighting in the funeral home parking lot. I left the funeral walking. I can laugh about it now, but in the moment, I realized that I was doing the same things that he did that led him where he was. He wanted to live for himself and be selfish because it's the only way that he knew. Me, on the other hand, I had that resiliency from my childhood, from my grandpa. He loved me unconditionally. And yes, he bought me, you know, anything I ever wanted. I took a nap one day and he bought me a dollhouse because I wouldn't take a nap unless he bought me a dollhouse. But he loved me unconditionally, and that has instilled in me now to be able to overcome the things that my parents did then. And then I can be the example for my son and try to change what went on in life. I want this cycle to end with me. Now, my son's journey may end up something like mine, but I'm in a position where I know that I can handle that. I know that I can pray him through it. I know the direction to send him to when or if that time ever happens. But he's got such a hatred for alcohol right now that I just don't see that happening. Thank God. Something good came out of it. He is brilliant, but he's also at risk, just like we all are. So I try to teach him the things that I learned here because he won't come to a meeting with me. I don't know why. I think he'd enjoy it. But I try to teach him the little things that we learn in AA so it can save his life on down the road. And my grandkids' lives don't have to be suffered by it either. I hope he doesn't have kids for a long, long time. Because I don't want to be a grandma. I don't want to be mama yet. You know? But what we do in our day-to-day affects what other people do in their day-to-day. What we do in our lives affects the people's lives around us all the time. And we need to remember that as we go on through our days. But we also need to give ourselves grace, because there are going to be times when we're not perfect and everything's not okay. And it's okay to be not okay sometimes. Just reach out to the people who you know are going to lead you in the right direction. Reach out to the ones that you know are going to have your back. I was given an opportunity to get a house here recently. And I didn't realize that I was making an impact as I was until I met the people that I met to help me along this process, because you have to have sponsors to be able to go through this housing program that I'm in. And whenever I approached the people to be able to help me, I didn't realize that they had already been watching who I was and how I was and what I'd been doing. And in doing so, I've made some of the best friends that I've ever had in my entire life. And I have people now that I can rely on. And I've never had that. People I can trust, I've never had that. I can trust myself. Never had that. Never, ever. I can be a better person because of what these 12 steps has taught me to do. It's not just about what it is we do on paper, it's about what it is we do in here. Who it is that we change in us affects who it is that we change in other people. And I want to aspire to be the people who have inspired me. Maybe not be a substance abuse counselor, because I've seen what they've been through, and I really don't know if I really want to go through all that. I really don't. I'm like, oh, God, I don't know. And then you're like, oh, no. And then one of them fails or something, and you're like, God, that's on me. And it's like, no, it's not. Don't do that to yourself. But I just don't know. Josie looked at me one time, and I was crying about something. I forget what it was. But she said, and you want to do this for a living? And I'm like, nope. Not now. But sharing my story invigorates me. It reminds me of where I've been and where I've come from and who I am now and who I am not anymore. And I want to be able to touch other people's lives with what it is that I've been through and what it is that I've done and what it is that I've gained out of all of it. I want to be able to be that one little thing that leaves somebody's life better than it was when I met them. You know what I mean? I want to be that light and that purity that somebody gets to see. And I hope that what I've had to say this morning resonates somewhere within somebody about something. I hope that I left your life a little bit better than it was whenever I first came up here. And I hope that I've made some more friends in the process of all of it. And that's all I got, y'all. I don't know if I don't know what.